Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now, with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/arts. Just go to Indeed.com/arts right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/arts. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
You know the name. You definitely know the face. But how well do you really know Daniel Radcliffe?
Right.
The actor who, I mean, brought one of the most beloved literary characters ever to life.
Right. For so many people, he is Harry Potter. That link is just inseparable.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But what if we told you that his journey beyond the wizarding world is actually even more fascinating, maybe more unexpected? It's like a masterclass in defying expectations.
It really is.
So today we're embarking on a deep dive into the extraordinary life and, well, the constantly evolving career of Daniel Radcliffe.
Mm-hmm.
We've pulled together a comprehensive biography, basically charting his whole trajectory from this unparalleled child star to, well, a really versatile performer, a devoted family man, and a pretty outspoken activist, too.
Quite the combination.
Our mission here is to get past those surface narratives, you know, to extract the essential nuggets of knowledge, the insights that really show the surprising breadth of his talent.
Yeah, the choices he made.
The deliberate, sometimes audacious career choices.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And the personal convictions that truly define him. We'll unpack how he handled, the unique pressure of global fame.
Unimaginable pressure.
Consciously defied typecasting and powerfully used his platform for causes he really believes in. Get ready for some serious aha moments, because this deep dive, it promises to be a study in reinvention and integrity.
I think what's really striking is the sheer audacity, as you said, of his post-Potter choices. They almost seem designed to challenge what a child star should do next.
Totally.
Indeed. Radcliffe's path offers just a compelling study in how a young person thrust into that kind of unimaginable fame consciously sculpts an authentic identity and a remarkably diverse career.
Right.
It really raises an important question for all of us, doesn't it? How do you move from being a global icon, recognized everywhere for one role, to simply being a respected actor known for, well, a whole range of work?
It's not automatic, that's for sure.
No, it's a journey of intentionality, really, and it offers a lot of insights, I think.
So let's dive right in. Where did it all begin for Daniel Jacob Radcliffe? Born in London, July 23, 1989. And his roots in the entertainment industry, they actually run surprisingly deep. It almost feels like it set the stage.
Yeah, it's not just a coincidence.
His mother, Marcia Janine Gresham, was a casting agent. She was involved in BBC productions, things like the Inspector Linley mysteries.
Right.
And his father, Alan George Radcliffe, worked as a literary agent. Now, okay, it's not super uncommon for kids of industry people to follow that path. But what's really telling here is that both his parents had actually acted as children themselves.
Ah, that's the key bit, isn't it?
Yeah. This shared background, this sort of innate understanding of the craft, the industry, from both sides, it likely provided an early spark, a unique perspective for Daniel's own ambition. It wasn't just, being around the business. It was like an inheritance of passion.
That's a really crucial point. It sets the context. This wasn't like a case of pushy parents trying to get their kid into the limelight for money or something.
No, not at all.
The source material shows Daniel himself expressed a desire to act when he was just 5 years old. Five. That points to an intrinsic drive, something that was nurtured, not forced.
Wow.
And this early, organic interest, combined with his parents' intimate knowledge of the industry, well, it gave him a distinct advantage, didn't it? They understood the nuances, the demands, and maybe crucially, the potential pitfalls.
They knew what he might be getting into.
Exactly. It laid a groundwork of practical understanding and personal support that, frankly, a lot of child actors just don't have. And, you might be surprised how deeply he explored his own identity even before the huge fame hit. He did that BBC genealogy series, Who Do You Think You Are?
Oh, right. I remember that.
Yeah. He uncovered his Jewish mother's Ashkenazi ancestry, tracing this really vibrant lineage through immigrants from Germany, Lithuania, Poland, Russia, all over.
And on his Northern Irish father's side, he found a very working-class Protestant family from Banbridge in County Down. This personal exploration, it definitely adds layers to his identity, showing this rich tapestry of heritage before he became, you know, Harry Potter.
It reminds you that even these global icons have these really personal, complex histories.
Absolutely. And some of that history, it's quite poignant, even tragic. He found out his maternal great-grandfather, Samuel Gershon, was a jeweler in Hatton Garden who tragically died by suicide after his business was robbed.
Oh, my gosh.
And the police were initially skeptical, thinking it might have been fraud. It led to his widow changing her name from Gershon to Gresham. It's just a stark reminder of the challenges his family faced and the resilience maybe passed down.
That's heavy stuff.
Yeah. And on his father's side, he looked into his great-great-uncles, four brothers who all fought in World War I. One of them, Ernie, was sadly killed. These stories just add this profound depth to his personal narrative long before the camera started rolling.
Definitely puts things in perspective.
Mm.
And speaking of cameras, this early ambition, it quickly led to his acting debut, right? Which set him on this unprecedented path, though maybe a quiet start.
Indeed. His professional debut was at age 10. BBC One's two-part adaptation of Charles Dickens' David Copperfield back in 1999. He played the young David.
A classic role to start with.
Absolutely. And his film debut followed pretty soon after in The Tailor of Panama in 2001. That was an American spy novel adaptation, had moderate commercial success.
Okay.
These initial roles, I mean, they obviously weren't blockbusters like what came later, but they were absolutely crucial. They gave him vital practical on-set experience. He learned the rhythms of production, acting for camera.
Without the crazy spotlight.
Exactly. Without that intense global spotlight that was literally just around the corner. Imagine at 10 performing in a Dickens classic. It speaks to a certain seriousness, a dedication to the craft even then. He was building a foundation, quietly.
A proving ground, like you said. But then came that, well, seemingly serendipitous meeting that just changed everything, didn't it? Changed his life, maybe even global cinema in a way.
Yeah, the big one.
In 2000, producer David Heyman met Radcliffe. He was at the theater with his dad, and Heyman happened to be friends with his dad.
Right, that connection.
Heyman then asked him to audition for Harry Potter. And director Chris Columbus, he recalled seeing a video of Daniel in David Copperfield and just immediately thinking, this is what I want. This is Harry Potter.
Instant recognition.
Even J.K. Rowling herself endorsed him. Said, I don't think Chris Columbus could have found a better Harry. It sounds almost, I don't know, faded, doesn't it?
It does, but here's a critical insight, often missed in all the talk about child stardom. How his parents didn't just manage his career, they actively negotiated for his childhood.
Ah, okay. Tell me more about that.
Well, this wasn't just a casual audition. It was an offer for a multi-film commitment that would define his entire adolescence. And initially, his parents actually turned it down.
Really? Turned down Harry Potter?
Yes. Primarily concerned about a proposed 6-film commitment that would mean shooting mostly in Los Angeles, essentially uprooting their young son, putting him in a totally different environment.
Wow. Okay. That makes sense.
So Warner Bros. Strategically countered. They offered a 2-film contract with shooting primarily in the UK. That was the crucial detail for his parents. And ultimately, it was a foundational decision for preserving some semblance of his childhood, grounding him at home.
That's huge. That's incredible foresight.
It wasn't just good parenting. It was a deliberate protective strategy. It provided a psychological buffer against the very pressures that derail so many young actors. This careful management really laid the groundwork for how he'd navigate the immense fame later on.
So it wasn't just handed to him on a plate, that initial, no, the negotiation. It really highlights the deliberate thought and the huge responsibility his parents took on.
It's really remarkable for such high stakes.
And with that pivotal decision, the wizarding world beckoned. Life changed forever.
Absolutely. The role of his parents, not just nurturing his talent, but safeguarding his well-being right from the start. It's an invaluable lesson in the world of child stardom. Their careful management gave him that stable foundation amidst, well, extraordinary circumstances.
And navigated he did, though, yeah, not without significant challenges. His education, for instance. He went to 3 private London schools, Redcliffe, Sussex House, City of London School. But it got incredibly difficult after the first Harry Potter film came out.
I can imagine.
Apparently, some fellow pupils became openly hostile, trying to, quote, have a crack at the kid that plays Harry Potter, which is just brutal for a kid dealing with global fame.
Awful.
Just awful.
So he ended up continuing his education with on-set tutors. And he's been really open about it, admitted he wasn't a great student, found traditional school useless and really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
He did get A grades and 3 AS levels in 2006, but then made the deliberate decision not to go to university. He knew his passion was acting and screenwriting. It just paints this picture of a childhood that was anything but ordinary. It really underscores the isolation and the unique pressures child stars face.
Mm-hmm.
And that decision to skip university, driven by clear career goals and like a strong sense of purpose, it speaks volumes about his maturity even then.
Yeah, he knew what he wanted.
It also raises that important question about the support structures needed for child actors. His parents' involvement from the contract talks to the very prudent financial management seems absolutely crucial in providing some normalcy, some stability amidst it all.
Let's talk about the money, because the numbers are just mind-boggling.
They really are. He earned a 7-figure salary for the very first Harry Potter film.
Wow. As a kid.
Yeah. Which his parents wisely chose to invest for him, protecting him from having immediate access to that kind of cash. By the 6th film, his earnings jumped to around $15
million. $15
million. And then an astonishing $39 million for the final 2 films combined.
Good grief.
Accumulating an estimated $75.4 million just from the franchise alone. He was even ranked at one point as the richest teenager in England, net worth of $14 million back in 2006. That's now estimated around $95 million as of 2021.
That scale of earnings,
mm-hmm.
it just highlights the unique pressures and how vital his parents' guidance must have been in managing that responsibly, investing it, not squandering it.
Absolutely. That financial stability directly enabled his later artistic freedom. He could choose roles based on merit, not just needing a paycheck.
So this kind of wealth, this fame, at such a young age,
yeah,
it's almost unimaginable. And he clearly navigated with huge help and foresight from his family. What does that mean for how a young person develops their identity when their reality is so detached from their peers?
It creates a fascinating duality, doesn't it? On one hand, financial security removes a common pressure point, allows for choices based on artistic merit. On the other, it must create a really unusual relationship with concepts like work and value from day one. His parents' active management seems less about control and more about providing anchors in a surreal reality. Teaching financial responsibility, ensuring the wealth became a tool for future independence, not, you know, a burden.
That foundation, built on guidance and personal resilience, must have been vital as the Harry Potter saga just exploded.
Absolutely critical.
The release of Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone in 2001 was, I mean, instant. Massive success, captivated everyone worldwide. Critics, like Bob Graham of the San Francisco Chronicle, hailed Radcliffe as the embodiment of every reader's imagination.
High praise right out of the gate.
The series just kept dominating. Box office, cultural consciousness, Chamber of Secrets in 2002, Prisoner of Azkaban in 2004. But like you said, there were growing pains. For Azkaban, for example, the New York Times critic A.O. Scott felt Emma Watson had to carry him with her performance.
Yeah, that shows the early critical scrutiny, the immense pressure he faced learning his craft in public.
Right, learning on the biggest stage possible.
And this period really illustrates that unique challenge. A child actor developing skills under a global microscope. While critics might point to uneven moments, it's crucial to remember that's a natural part of any actor's growth, just made incredibly difficult when millions are watching every move.
Definitely.
But what's insightful is how he consistently chose to embrace it, learn from it. For Goblet of Fire, for instance, he singled out the humor as a key reason for that film's creative success. It shows his personal engagement, a developing understanding of storytelling beyond just his own lines.
He wasn't just phoning it in.
No, this was his formative education playing out in real time.
And as the series went on, his confidence, his mastery of the role, it clearly grew. By Order of the Phoenix in 2007, Radcliffe said director David Yates and co-star Imelda Staunton made it the most fun film to work on.
You could see that chemistry.
And his performance even earned him the 2008 National Movie Award for Best Male Performance.
Yeah.
That's a significant validation, right, of his maturing in the role.
Absolutely.
And you probably remember that iconic moment when the trio, Radcliffe, Watson, Grint, left their handprints, footprints, and one prints at Grauman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood.
Oh, yeah. Cemented in history. Literally.
It was such a tangible mark of their global impact, their almost mythical status by then.
And that signifies a critical period of maturation, both personally and professionally, within the franchise. The success, his growth, the recognition,
It positioned him uniquely for whatever came next.
Right. He was absorbing, learning.
And already thinking beyond Hogwarts, even as the series geared up for its grand finale.
And what a finale it was. The last book, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, famously split into two films, Part 1 in 2010, Part 2 in 2011, for, quote, financial and scripting reasons.
A decision that caused a bit of stir at the time, didn't it? Some fans felt it was just milking it.
Yeah, but Radcliffe robustly defended it, said it was absolutely necessary for a proper, respectful adaptation of that dense final novel.
Which, arguably, it was. And Deathly Hallows Part 2 grossed over $1.3 billion worldwide. Critically acclaimed, too. Anne Hornaday at the Washington Post even asked, maybe slightly surprised, who could have predicted that Radcliffe, Grint, and Watson would turn out to be good actors?
Backhanded compliment, perhaps, but it showed how far they'd come. It was a powerful capstone to a decade of unparalleled work in public growth.
Definitely.
And despite all the positive feelings, his pride in being linked to the series forever, Radcliffe has been super clear. No interest in doing more Harry Potter films. He believed 10 years is a long time to spend with one character.
That decision to deliberately move on, despite the guaranteed success of revisiting it.
It speaks volumes about his artistic integrity, his desire for new challenges. And what's really insightful is his assertion that he didn't feel he missed out on a childhood. He actually said, I've been given a much better perspective on life by doing Potter. That's a huge statement, isn't it?
Yeah.
To say playing a world-famous wizard actually gave you a better perspective, didn't take it away.
Right.
What does that maturity tell us about how he viewed his future? How it influenced those next choices.
It speaks to someone who really understood the unique privilege and the challenge of his situation, and crucially, how he chose to frame it. This mature perspective from so young truly set the stage for his deliberate diversification, the thoughtful choices he made post-Potter.
It shows that conscious effort to define himself beyond the role.
Exactly. To leverage the visibility not for more of the same, but for genuine artistic exploration. Understanding his own narrative was key to that successful transition.
And redefine himself. He absolutely did. Which brings us nicely to section two, Beyond Hogwarts, where he truly started forging an adult career on stage and screen. And it was as strategic as it was daring.
Mm-hmm. The theatrical plunge first.
Yes. Arguably the most pivotal, maybe courageous step. He did a small stage thing in 2002, a guest spot in the play What I Wrote. But the big moment was Equus.
Right, 2007.
At just 17, he takes the lead role, Alan Strang, in this West End revival. Peter Shaffer's intense psychological play.
Hugely challenging part.
Playing a stable boy obsessed with horses.
Yeah.
And yeah, famously including a full nude scene. This move generated, as you can imagine, significant pre-opening media interest.
Understatement.
And it was a deliberate bid to demonstrate that he was prepared for adult roles, directly challenging that Harry Potter perception.
And it wasn't just bold. It was strategically calculated, directly addressing that huge challenge of typecasting, performing nude in such a dramatically intense role. It was a clear, unambiguous statement. I am not just Harry Potter anymore.
It wasn't just shock value.
No, it was about artistic intent, demonstrating range. And the critical acclaim for Equus was immense. Charles Spencer of The Telegraph wrote Radcliffe displays a dramatic power and an electrifying stage presence that marks a tremendous leap forward. Spencer even added, quite powerfully, I never thought I would find the diminutive. Radcliffe a sinister figure, but as Alan Strang. There are moments when he seems genuinely scary in his rage and confusion.
That's incredible feedback.
It wasn't just a successful play. It was a successful career recalibration, showcasing raw talent previously hidden by, you know, a wand and glasses.
And you could almost feel his nerves about taking it to Broadway in 2008. He admitted he thought American audiences were more discerning than London ones.
That humility, that desire to really prove himself.
It speaks volumes about his dedication. And he got a Drama Desk Award nomination for it, cementing his credibility as a serious stage actor.
Indeed. That success paved the way for more challenging theater. It showed critics, audiences, everyone that his talent went far beyond fantasy and effects. He had genuine passion, was willing to stretch himself.
A conscious breaking away. A signal he was in control of his artistic destiny.
Precisely.
And from dramatic nudity and intense psychodrama. He then dives headfirst into Broadway musicals.
Another huge leap.
Debuted as J. Pierpont Finch in the 2011 Broadway revival of How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. A role held by legends like Robert Morse, Matthew Broderick.
Big shoes to fill.
And the production, Radcliffe himself got overwhelmingly favorable reviews. USA Today said he ultimately succeeds not by overshadowing his fellow cast members, but by working in conscientious harmony with them and having a blast in the process.
That's fantastic.
Earned him multiple nominations, even a Grammy nomination for the cast recording.
Moving into musicals showed another dimension of his talent. Singing, dancing on a major Broadway stage. Such a contrast to the often serious Harry Potter. Just incredible versatility.
And a willingness to embrace totally different demands.
Yeah, what's compelling is that deliberate pattern. Choosing roles demanding different skills, actively challenging perceptions. Textbook example of diversifying your portfolio, challenging preconceived notions.
Kept doing it too, right? More stage work.
Oh, yeah. His commitment continued. He played Billy Clavin in Martin McDonagh's. The Cripple of Inishman in 2013 won a What's On Stage Award for Best Actor for that.
Great play.
And then he played the writer in the documentary theater piece Privacy in 2016. His commitment was so thorough, he actually spent a full day fact-checking at the New Yorker just to prepare.
Seriously, fact-checking at the New Yorker.
Yep. That depth of preparation, whether for drama, musical, or meta-theater, it just speaks to an actor truly committed to understanding his roles.
It's astonishing, isn't it? Dramatic nudity, Broadway song and dance, fact-checking. He was clearly determined to show he could do anything and excel. For you, the learner, this just reveals such a strategic approach to building a career.
Absolutely. Each choice was a deliberate step away from the Potter shadow, allowing him to grow, cultivate a new audience who recognized his range, not random projects, carefully selected opportunities to reshape his identity.
And beyond the stage, his film choices were equally diverse. Almost like he was throwing darts at a genre board in the best way.
Yeah, zigzagging all over the place.
First post-Potter film project. The 2012 horror film The Woman in Black, adapted from Susan Hill's novel. Radcliffe said he was incredibly excited about the beautifully written script.
Smart move. Gothic horror, a stark contrast to Hogwarts, allowed him to play a mature, somber character experiencing real grounded fear.
A clear strategic pivot. Leaving magic for chills.
And this curated selection of roles, it just speaks volumes about his artistic ambition. Consistently opting for challenges, not just resting on laurels or chasing guaranteed hits. A conscious effort to show brighter capability.
And the sheer variety that followed is just astounding. He paints this picture of an actor totally unburdened by commercial expectations, driven by artistic curiosity.
He really seemed to seek roles that physically and psychologically distanced him from his past.
Right, like plunging into gritty character studies. Kill Your Darlings in 2013, playing the beat poet Allen Ginsberg. That demands total immersion.
And that's where he met his partner, Aaron Dark.
Yes. Then there was the critically acclaimed Imperium in 2016, playing an FBI agent infiltrating a white supremacist group. I mean, talk about challenging audience expectations. Got an 84% on Rotten Tomatoes, too.
What's remarkable there is how he consistently chose projects that stretched him emotionally, intellectually, exploring darker, more nuanced parts of the human condition. Not just showing versatility, proving his depth as a dramatic actor.
He was capable of serious character-driven work.
Definitely.
And then there's his amazing embrace of the bizarre.
Yeah.
The genre-bending stuff, showcasing a truly fearless approach.
He really leaned into the weird.
Rom-com with the F-word in 2013. Then veered wildly into dark fantasy horror with Horns the same year, playing a character growing literal horns.
Talk about embracing the outlandish.
Though, funny story, on the set of Horns, he accidentally drank antifreeze, was horrendously ill for 3 days.
Oh my God, that's memorable. Glad he was okay.
Me too. Then less dramatically, sci-fi horror in Victor Frankenstein in 2015, played Sam Houser, Rockstar Games founder, in The Game Changers that year too.
Right.
And he even played an antagonist, seemed to relish it, in Now You See Me Too in 2016, playing Michael Caine's son who resents magic.
Which is a neat little meta commentary on his own history, isn't it?
Totally.
This willingness to inhabit the quirky, the unconventional, the downright bizarre. It's a real hallmark of his post-Potter career. He wasn't afraid of strange or fantastical roles, but always grounded them with commitment.
It shows an actor truly unburdened by needing to seem serious.
Yeah, willing to dive into projects offering pure creative joy, artistic exploration, pushing boundaries of what audiences expected.
And maybe most strikingly, he literally played a talkative corpse named Manny in the indie surreal drama Swiss Army Man in 2016.
The Farting Corks movie?
Yes. A talkative corpse. This man truly has no fear of a weird script, does he? So for you, the listener, Huda, that's this incredibly eclectic mix, gritty dramas to literal talking corpses impact his reputation in Hollywood. He's definitely not being typecast.
Not a chance. This selection speaks volumes about his artistic ambition, his independence. It shows a conscious, almost defiant effort to challenge himself across genres, constantly prove his capabilities beyond that one iconic character.
He's shaping his own narrative.
Exactly. Choosing projects on artistic merit, the unique challenge, not just commercial appeal or fitting a box. For Hollywood, it marks him as reliable, versatile, and crucially, an actor who brings intellectual curiosity and commitment to every role, no matter how unusual. He's built a reputation for being genuinely interesting.
And his career expansion didn't stop there. He moved robustly into TV, even voice acting, embracing all mediums.
Right, miracle workers.
Yes. Starred as Craig in that TBS comedy limited series, 2019 to 2023. Took on different roles as it became an anthology in Angel, Prince in the Dark Ages.
Showcased his comedic chops there, too.
Totally. He also voiced a character in Playmobil, the movie in 2019, and other recent films. The action comedy Guns Akimbo in 2020, the thriller Escape from Pretoria that same year, based on a real prison escape.
Keeping busy.
Even popped up in the Netflix special Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt in 2020 as Prince Frederick.
This steady stream of varied work, especially in TV, it shows that consistent desire to evolve, reach different audiences, prove his staying power across platforms.
Definitely.
And his willingness to do the Harry Potter 20th anniversary, return to Hogwarts special in 2022. It suggests a healthy comfort with his past, doesn't it? Not running from it.
Yeah, a good balance.
He found a way to honor his origins without letting them define his future. Shows real maturity in his relationship with that foundational role. He gets it's part of his story, but not the whole book.
And his more recent roles just keep impressing, cementing that versatility. You'll love him as the villain, Abigail Fairfax, opposite Sandra Bullock and Channing Tatum in The Lost City in 2022. Such fun.
He seemed to enjoy playing the bad guy.
But maybe his most talked about role recently, the one that really showcases unexpected range, was playing Weird Al Yankovic in the biographical parody Weird, The Al Yankovic Story.
Oh, that was brilliant.
Right. And it earned him nominations for a Primetime Emmy, a British Academy Television Award, big mainstream recognition for his comedic talent, really cemented his ability to transform, embrace the outlandish.
That embrace of such an unconventional role, especially comedy and parody, it just shows an actor totally unburdened by needing to maintain a serious image. He's willing to delve into projects offering pure creative joy.
And the acclaim for Weird proves those choices are paying off.
He's not just surviving child stardom. He's flourishing in this really unique way. But what's equally compelling, maybe inseparable from his professional choices, is how he's used his platform for causes way beyond the screen. His personal convictions reveal just as much about the man.
Absolutely. He's a hero on and off screen, consistently showing this powerful sense of social responsibility. He's actively supported various charities for years. He actually designed something called the Q-Bed for Habitat's VIP Kids Range.
A Q-Bed? What's that?
It's like a cube made of 8 smaller ones. You can arrange it into a bed or a chaise lounge or a chair. And all the royalties went straight to his favorite charity, Demelza House Children's Hospice in Kent.
Wow, that's really creative engagement, not just writing a check.
Exactly. He's even urged fans, you know, donate to their Candle for Care program instead of sending him Christmas presents, using his influence for tangible good.
Little things too, right?
Yeah, in 2008, he was one of several celebrities who donated old glasses to an exhibit honoring Holocaust victims, a quiet but meaningful gesture. During Aquis on Broadway, he auctioned off jeans and stuff from the show for Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS.
Right.
Presented their Gypsy of the Year competition, too.
Yeah.
And he supports Get Connected UK, a helpline for troubled youth in London.
This consistent pattern of giving and an advocacy, it shows a deep, ingrained sense of social responsibility. He doesn't just lend his name. He actively participates, creates, encourages others, using his platform for measurable good.
For sure.
And his most prominent, most impactful advocacy is probably for the LGBTQ+ community. He started filming PSAs back in 2009 for the Trevor Project.
Right, the Gay Teen Suicide Prevention Organization.
Exactly. He learned about them while doing Equus on Broadway in 2008, contributed financially, and received their Hero Award in 2011 for his contributions.
He's been very vocal.
Very direct. He said in a 2010 interview, "I have always hated anybody who is not tolerant of gay men or lesbians or bisexuals. Now I am in the very fortunate position where I can actually help or do something about it. It's active commitment."
And this is where his journey gets really compelling and, frankly, deeply inspiring. You might remember his impactful essay for the Trevor Project in June 2020. He voiced strong support for the transgender community.
Yes, that was significant.
And critically, he expressed regret that J.K. Rowling's statements on gender had tarnished some fans' experience of the Harry Potter books. That was a huge moment, taking a very public stand, even when it was difficult, potentially contentious, given his link to the franchise.
It really showed his values run deep, transcending commercial stuff.
Totally. So for you, the listener, what does this bold stance tell us about how he uses his platform, his understanding of his own moral compass?
It highlights those moral complexities of being a public figure tied so tightly to a franchise, especially when the creator's views diverge sharply from your own. His decision to publicly back the trans community, despite his association with Rowling, it shows a powerful commitment to his values.
It encourages critical thinking too, doesn't it? Separating art from artist or actor from author here.
Exactly. It raises that important question about personal integrity when faced with public association. The courage needed to stand by your convictions, even when it might be professionally inconvenient. He clearly prioritized what he believed was right over potential friction with the franchise that made him famous.
Beyond his public advocacy, his personal convictions paint an equally fascinating, nuanced picture. Shows a really independent mind.
Politically, for instance.
Yeah, he supports the Labour Party. Switched from the Lib Dems in 2012, apparently due to disillusionment with their performance in government. Approved of Ed Miliband then.
Right.
Even endorsed Jeremy Corbyn's Labour leadership campaign in 2015, citing Corbyn's sincerity. But then he also publicly supports abolishing the British monarchy, wants a republic. Sees it as outdated.
Okay, so quite progressive there.
Yet, despite those views, he also supports British unionism.
Mm.
He opposed the 2014 Scottish independence referendum because he personally likes the UK being how it is.
Interesting mix. Not straightforwardly one thing or another.
Not at all.
These nuanced positions show a thoughtful engagement with issues, not just ideological alignment. He forms his own considered views, even if they seem contradictory at first glance, reveals a complex individual.
Yeah.
And what's equally compelling is that layered identity he describes with religion and heritage. He identifies as Jewish and Irish, despite the fact that I'm English, notes his family are Christmas tree Jews, humorously suggesting secular observance.
Right, acknowledges the heritage without strict religious practice.
He is an atheist. In 2012, called himself a militant atheist when religion starts impacting on legislation. Though by 2019, he softened that slightly, described himself as agnostic leaning toward atheism.
So evolving views there too.
And he's called himself a fierce patriot, but not a royalist, saying the monarchy symbolized a lot of what is wrong with the country. He just doesn't fit neatly into any single box.
Definitely not. A self-described fierce patriot, but anti-monarchy, an atheist proud of his Jewish heritage. This complex blend speaks to a deeply thoughtful person.
Indeed. It encourages us to look beyond simplistic labels, recognize the intricate complexities of belief, heritage, political thought. It raises that question of how our backgrounds shape us, even when we diverge from traditional paths, and how someone can hold seemingly disparate convictions without contradiction to themselves.
His self-description challenges us to appreciate the rich, sometimes surprising, nature of identity.
Mm.
And his personal life shows a similar groundedness, commitment to authenticity. He splits his time, London and New York, keeps that balance.
And his long-term relationship.
Yes, with American actress Erin Dark since 2012. Met on the set of Kill Your Darlings, they welcomed a son in April 2023.
Oh, lovely news.
And Daniel spoke with just profound joy about fatherhood, called it the literal best thing that ever happened to me. He credits his family, especially his parents' stable 30-year marriage, for keeping him grounded, inspiring his own relationship values.
That shows a clear priority on personal stability amidst a very public life.
Definitely.
This stable personal life, consciously cultivated away from that intense earlier scrutiny, it's a testament to his values, his deliberate desire for normalcy. You see a man prioritizing family, building a quiet, fulfilling life as an anchor.
And he's navigated personal challenges too, hasn't he?
Yes. Many might not know he has a mild form of dyspraxia. That's a neurological disorder affecting coordination, things like writing or tying shoelaces. He's openly discussed how it made him feel crap at everything at school.
Wow, that vulnerability adds another layer, likely shaped his resilience.
For sure. And he also became teetotal back in August 2010. Realized he was too reliant on alcohol during the filming of Half-Blood Prince. He talked about that journey very openly on BBC Radio 4's Desert Island Discs.
I remember that interview. Very candid.
And he stressed how his parents' unwavering support, his decision to stay in England, were crucial for coping with the immense fame during that challenging time. Underscores the importance of a strong support system.
It's incredible how openly he shares these struggles, gives insights into the man beyond the persona, and his interests are just as varied and eclectic as his career.
Like what?
He loves hip-hop music. Once flawlessly rhymed Blackalicious's Alphabet Aerobics on The Tonight Show starring Jimmy Fallon, absolutely nailed it.
No way. Hidden talent.
Totally. His favorite films range from 12 Angry Men to Dr. Strangelove. Favorite novel is Mikhail Bulgakov's The Master and Margarita. And he's an avid ping pong player.
Quite the mix.
So for you, the learner, what does this all mean? Overcoming dyspraxia, embracing fatherhood, navigating personal demons, dropping sick rhymes on TV. He's truly a man of many surprising talents and experiences.
This rich tapestry of personal experiences, challenges, diverse interests, it really underscores the importance of a strong personal foundation, a broad array of passions in navigating and thriving beyond that kind of immense public pressure. This comprehensive look gives us a full, well-rounded picture of the man.
It shows how these elements contribute to his resilience, his authentic self, his ability to stay grounded while reaching for ambitious artistic heights.
It's almost a blueprint for building a life of purpose, isn't it?
And his path ahead shows no signs of slowing down, just evolving further. His commitment to diverse, challenging work continues with real vigor. Early 2022, he returned to the stage New York Theater Workshop revival of Sondheim's Merrily We Roll Along, played Charlie Kringis.
Which is a huge hit.
Massive. Acclaimed production, transferred to Broadway, huge praise, closed its run July 2024.
And winning the Tony Award for Best Featured Actor in a Musical for that. I mean, that's a pinnacle achievement for any stage actor.
Huge validation.
It further solidifies his status as a serious, highly respected theatrical performer, miles away from his child star origins. A powerful testament to his dedication, his continuous artistic growth, proves those earlier stage successes were no fluke.
He really earned that.
This trajectory of selective, diverse projects shows an actor truly in control of his narrative. Committed to artistic growth, not just chasing fame or fortune, he's carving out a legacy based on merit.
A Tony Award winner. Extraordinary achievement. Capping off years of dedicated stage work, and his upcoming slate looks just as exciting, just as diverse.
That's next.
Looking ahead, you can anticipate seeing him with Ethan Hawke and Jessica Biel in a biographical film called Batso. And with Lucas Hedges in a war thriller, Trust the Man.
Okay, more film work.
And get this. April 2025 reported that a film version of Merrily We Roll Along, starring Radcliffe and his stage co-stars, got picked up by Sony Pictures Classics. U.S. release set for December 5, 2025.
Oh, fantastic. Bringing that Tony-winning performance to a wider audience.
Exactly. And May 2025 announced he'll star in a Tina Fey-produced TV series, The Fall and Rise of Reggie Dinkins, with Tracy Morgan and Erica Alexander.
Wow, busy guy.
It's clear he's only just begun, no intention of slowing down. What's truly fascinating is how he just keeps pushing his boundaries, constantly seeking new forms of expression.
Indeed. His upcoming projects underscore that sustained commitment to creative fulfillment, challenging roles across mediums, indie film, major TV, adapting his stage work. It reinforces the narrative. An actor not just surviving past fame, but actively thriving, expanding his artistic footprint, consistently defying expectations.
It leaves you wondering.
What new and surprising territory will Daniel Radcliffe explore next?
So you've just taken a deep dive into the remarkable journey of Daniel Radcliffe. We've explored his transformation from world's most famous child star to, well, a Tony-winning actor.
A passionate, courageous activist for LGBTQ+ rights.
A dedicated family man. And an individual defined by this fascinating array of personal beliefs and interests. His career is just a powerful testament to resilience, deliberate choice, and a profound commitment to authenticity, mm-hmm. both on and off screen.
Mm-hmm.
What you, the learner, can really take away from this is a powerful understanding that navigating that kind of immense public scrutiny, it requires a strong inner compass. A willingness to strategically take risks that challenge perceptions.
Yeah, not just any risks, but calculated ones.
Right, and an unwavering commitment to personal values that go way beyond any single role or career path. Daniel Radcliffe hasn't merely survived child stardom. He has literally redefined what it means to thrive beyond it, building a career, a life, entirely on his own terms.
In a world that often wants to pigeonhole public figures, define us by our biggest hits, Daniel Radcliffe really stands out, constantly reinventing himself while staying profoundly true to his core identity, his values, mm-hmm. which raises an important question for you to ponder, maybe in your own life. How can we, in our own careers, our personal journeys, embrace our multifaceted identities and deliberately carve out paths that honor our true selves, even when external expectations or past achievements try to define us?
Something to think about.